listener production.
Shares.
Market.
The S&P.
The ASX.
Stocks.
This is Motley Fool Money.
Welcome to Motley Fool Money, the podcast that didn't have to hand down a budget this week. I am Scott Phillips from The Motley Fool. He is Andrew Page from Strawman.com. Not only is he from Strawman.com, he's the founder. He is the managing director. And as I like to say, he's the chief cook and bottle washer. He's not the only man there, but he is the only one who does the cooking and the bottle washing. So Andrew is the aptly described. I want to see a business card, Ram, from you with chief cook and bottle washer on it. Can I get that out of you?
I probably should. I've said to you before, I've never, like, every job you have, you get issued a box of business cards. I think I've probably got about 8 boxes around somewhere. I probably only ever handed out 4 in my entire life.
I've been at the Motley Fool now for the best part of 11 years. I still have half of the original box I first got made up for me with like a title that was like 3 titles ago, and we just haven't bothered to replace it because, you know, why bother? I was asked for a business card for the first time the other day, and I thought, if someone asks for one, it's like, I'm thinking, should I have them then? Because if you're asked for one, like, you know, most people don't, but if you ask one, it's like, no, I don't have a business card. It's like, maybe I'm missing something. I don't know. Should I have a business card?
Nah.
No?
Maybe if you're exclusively having meetings with people over 60, then that'll help. You put your fax number on there and your
pager. You hate our audience, do you?
We've got a very young and sophisticated audience, but and those that are of that demographic.
That's how you hear us, Andrew, backpedaling very quickly. Mate, I know you wouldn't have a business card because Strawman is an online-only business, and there's no point handing out a digital business card. Unless you were trying to describe what strawman.com does, and I can't remember.
See, this is a good thing about a domain. It's strawman.com, no AU. Go there and it'll tell you everything you need to know. There yes. You go. That's my business card.
You're going to keep me in suspenders, are you? Not going to tell me what
I will.
There you go.
I will.
Right, fair enough. You'll have to look it up yourself, strawman.com. I don't know what it does. I did have, mate, an interesting... Let's start with a tangent, because that's what we do. An interesting discussion on Facebook during the week. I posted an article about the tax stuff.
It's always an interesting discussion
exactly.
on Facebook.
No, I write a regular email for Motley Fool listeners, for readers and members. So both, if you're on our mailing list or you're a member, you get an email from me 2 or 3 times a week, occasionally 4 if I'm really feeling ranty and want more to say. Because, you know, 2 podcast episodes, The Good Oil, and just a couple of emails a week is not quite enough sometimes. Sometimes I just need to get a little bit more out.
You are the opposite of cancelled. So
exactly. I don't know.
Platforms unplugged.
I'm middle-aged white and male, mate. I'm almost cancelled, as we know. Platforms on platforms. And I had an interesting conversation about what I would do with tax. And someone said, Scott Phillips for PM. And someone else suggested you should be the treasurer. I'm not sure about that. He replied, well, we want someone with conviction. I said, yes, but not that sort of conviction about those sort of policies. I did mention that maybe you might push for Bitcoin to become legal tender in the country. And so, you know, there's limits. I like you a lot, mate. I'm glad we do this podcast together. I'm not sure I'm ready to have you as my treasurer. I we can talk about it. There's always room. There's always it's a big tent. It's a large tent.
The good thing is it'll happen eventually anyway, so you don't need me to advocate for it.
And someone did post then a GIF of the Scarecrow from Wizard of Oz and said, if this is right. So that was just bringing it back to strawman.com for a second. So yes.
Hey, wait a sec. He didn't have a brain, right? Okay, let's just let that hang there.
Sometimes it's not great on podcasts. When you do it, it works. People go, what happened there? Yes, I couldn't possibly comment. Mate, yes, while we're here, let's do this early. We got a mailbag episode on Sunday. We have got mailbag episode next Sunday and the Sunday after that. And we we only have that episode when there's enough questions to answer. If you guys stop asking us questions, then we just, you know, We'll probably talk anyway.
Sunday off.
I don't know. You and I can't help ourselves. We talk about something and then we just wouldn't record it or something. But yes, hit us up on the socials, info@fool.com.au if you want to email us a question. For those people over 60 who don't love, you know, not having business cards, I'm still okay to accept your emails. Andrew, maybe not, but I will. Also, hit us up on Twitter. Andrew is exclusively. Are you going to be exclusive on Twitter when Elon takes over?
I'm kind of... I just don't know what to make of it. I think it's either going to be super exciting or a little bit scary. I don't know, but I'm going to stick with it. Here's the power. Here is the awesome power of network effects. Is that I guarantee you that Twitter will continue to keep on because You know, that's people who are on there that have any kind of following, get any kind of traction. That's where their audience is. That's where they're going to stay. And totally. Those that are there for the content will have to stay there because that's where everyone else is. It's beautiful when as a phenomena.
So do go and join that aforementioned network. Andrew is at @Sage_Simeon or at @StrawmanInvest. You can be on the Twitter or the Instagram at @TMFScottP or on Facebook at facebook.com/ScottPhillipsMoney. Yeah, lots of fun stuff. And come and have a chat. But more importantly, well, not for this purpose anyway, ask us your questions. Send your questions to us on any of those platforms. We will happily deal with those questions and answer them for you in our mailbag episodes. Mate, massive week this week. Massive week of macro. And you know, we've said before, the older I get, the less absolute I get about everything in life, which is one of those things about...
Sign of wisdom.
But thank you. I'll take that. That or just getting senile in my old age and my dotage. But I used to be really absolute about a whole lot of stuff, particularly about investing. And it was one of those things. And look, I still think it's true. You know, the old quote of, if you spend 15 minutes thinking about the macro, you've wasted 10 minutes. That kind of, you know. And it's an attractive line and it matters. And I'm going to say I still agree with that. With the exception that sometimes it is the exception that proves the rule. That sometimes stuff is just weird. And this week, we had two massive, massive bits of macro stuff going. We had a budget, and then we had literally the day after the CPI. I don't know why a government does a budget the day before the inflation numbers come out. It's like the RBA meeting the day before GDP numbers come out. It's like, guys, do it on a Thursday. You know, at least get the information before you make those decisions. Big budget this week. I've given it publicly a 7.5 out of 10. A nip and tuck budget, I've called it. It was a good budget for the times in the sense that Treasurer Chalmers had to deal with the economic circumstance in which we find ourselves. He couldn't either be seen to do anything that was going to make inflation worse. And so
he had the experience of the UK.
Right.
I'm sure that was very, very much front of mind.
And every time everyone was coming to his office said, "Hey, Jim, we should spend money on this," is like, dude, have you seen Liz Truss?
No.
Seriously. I'm not going to be your quasi-quoting for anything. I want to have this job more than a month, so I'm going to do the right thing. Yeah, so look, it was interesting. It was, such a contrast to the last federal budget. And it was one of those, there was so little to actually announce. There was kind of this narrative speech. You know, Josh Frydenberg's last one was, "Mr. Speaker, we know Australians are doing it tough, so we're going to unveil this, we're going to spend that, we're going to spend that, we're going to spend that, we're going to do this, we're going to spend that." And it was this real laundry list of, you know, tick box. The budget speech, I love it for the finance, I love it for the democracy, but I hate it for the politics. And they're political statements. But it was just remarkable that Jim Chalmers couldn't announce much. He kind of had, you know, those two or three, you know, paid parental leave, childcare, we'll talk about those in a sec. But this wasn't much else to announce. So he kind of just, it was more a narrative kind of speech about the sort of things he would like to do and the sort of reasons he'd like to do them, rather than the usual treasurer's speech, which is just, you know, money thrown out for everybody. He didn't have much choice. But so it's in there. I think 7.5 out of 10 is about right. There were things I would have done differently. But hard to say it wasn't the right budget for the times. Managed to make some changes where they did do spending. It wasn't inflationary spending. It was largely spent on things that are going to, you know, have more of a social or economic outcome rather than more spending in the economy. So I thought that was probably positive overall. They delivered on some budget promises, election promises they had to do. So that was the other thing. It was almost a mini budget. I mean, they could have done this as a press release, right? There was that little in there. It's like, yep, we're going to do the things we said we do in the election. Otherwise, things are pretty tough. See you next time. Did you have a takeaway from the budget?
It's easy to get into the weeds. I guess a couple high level thoughts just a pet peeve of mine is that 99% of media coverage tends to be sticking a microphone in someone's face who then tells you how it directly impersonally impacts them.
Yeah.
And like we are all judging merits or otherwise of this on how it impacts me personally. And of course, this is the nation's budget. There's going to be compromise. It's got to be the bigger picture kind of stuff. So I feel as though it would be more, it'd be nicer to have a more mature conversation coverage of it.
Yeah.
You know, it's obviously we all natural for us to want to have our own situation improved, but sometimes you got to think for the greater good. It's been my little hot take. I thought he was pretty good in giving us, you know, some hard truths. GDP growth forecast to halve between now and 2024.
That was, yeah.
You know, unemployment to rise. Mm-hmm. They're under no illusions. They're and at the same time, the deficit's increasing. So these are all real challenges. The problem is, and I know you've said this before as well, is that it is this tinkering because there are big structural questions at the heart of this that really need to be changed and are going to be hard decisions to make and unpopular for a lot of people as well. But it kind of has to be done. Not that there's a burning platform that it has to be done now. Actually, despite all the doom and gloom, Australia's net debt to GDP is 29%.
Yeah.
That's actually very low. The US is like 120, I think, 130%. Yeah. Europe's like through the roof. And generally speaking, historically, once you get above 100% on that metric, it doesn't end well. In most cases, statistically, it's like almost every company, a country, rather that has hit that has had very dire consequences. So we're in a really fortunate position. So I'd like to see us sort of, in a way, to have those big aspirational sort of goals to sort of set some North Stars is probably good to lead us back to a more sustainable path. So that was good. That's probably the extent of my take.
Yeah, I think
without getting into some of the specifics.
I think that's right. I will very quickly just touch on a couple of specifics. So paid parental leave being extended, I think it's just sensible. I think we can hopefully all agree that new parents having more time at home with the kid is a good thing. It'll cost some money, but it seems like, again, it's not inflationary. It's replacing your wage with a government payment. So they're kind of, one for one. I thought the early childhood education thing was a good thing. More places and more money being spent on them just means more people can be in the workforce if they choose to. I think that's also a good thing. I have said before pretty clearly, and I'm not big on being the sort of finance guy that all finance guys are supposed to be, nor are you. I do think we should just stop thinking about working parents, men and women, as economic units. Good, they can leave the kid in childcare and get back to work. It's like, if they want to, I love the option, right? But the idea that societally, it's a really good thing that we have to say, you know what, we should really, really push people back to the workforce. That'd be great.
I so agree. It's just this idea. I always say it. Everyone talks about the economy. It's this separate thing. It's all important. It's sort of we're the economy. It's people, right? It's there to kind of serve us. It's sort of a measure of how we interact. It drives me absolutely bonkers. One other quick point before. Sorry to interrupt, but there is I think a huge irony in this choice of going to work if you want for both parents, man or woman, husband or wife or whatever partner of other partner is that it's actually becoming less and less of a choice. And I think that's probably not to go into to segue into something which we probably don't want to, but I think it's probably related to just like the affordability of housing. If you want to buy a house, you are competing against other people who will both be wanting to work, who therefore the household income is higher, who therefore can afford a bigger mortgage, who therefore will push price up. So we've gotten into a bit of a spiral here, a self-referential loop where it's actually you don't really have much of a choice, which as I say is the biggest irony of all.
Yeah, I agree. I said that about house prices broadly. I know you're trying to avoid house prices, which I appreciate, but it was also the great achievement of feminism, of bringing women closer to equality. I'm not going to say we've got equality, we don't. Bringing women closer to equality was supposed to be, women can do anything, they can have a choice. And then as a society, we kind of then meant, so the choice is now taken away from you. You now have to work because house prices went up and you can't afford to buy a house without one. And so you go from this idea of let's liberate women to do whatever they want through to let's enslave women like blokes were. In theory, we should have said, great, two potential incomes. Let's actually, both work part-time, or let's, both work full-time, or, whatever choice you want to have, but the choice to be, made by the people, hopefully, who are doing that, rather than feel like, well, we don't really have a choice. If we want to buy a house in Sydney or Melbourne or Brisbane, we kind of both have to work, so I guess we're off to work.
Perhaps a lesson of that is because I think going back to a previous era where it was traditional for the man to go to work and the woman to stay at home raising the kids is that it just wasn't valued previously. There wasn't the economic value of someone staying home raising the kids doing all this stuff what wasn't seen. And now that everyone is forced to work, it's kind of like, oh, yeah, we have to spend billions on childcare and all this because exactly. It's that's how important it is. And again, I think I'm going to be really careful here because there's a lot of landmines around. I think it's a wonderful thing that things are more equal, 100%. Not fully equal, but more equal.
Yep.
But it's just that there are certain ironies in all of that.
Correct. Yeah, exactly. Point. I want to be really, really clear. I'm not saying that women's liberation or equality was the wrong thing. It's the fact that we as a society that and by the way, society, there was no conspiracy. Just the way that things work in society, we kind of went, hey, you got some extra money. We could use that to pay more for a different house if we wanted to. And the other guy said, well, I'll do that. And the other guy said, I'll do that. And the other guy said, I'll do that. And all of a sudden we all did. And then that's how prices go up. So it's just that as a general thought. Back to that though, the other thing I would say, this is a massive bugbear of mine. It's not even finance related slightly, but I'm going to do it because I got the bully pulpit and I'm going to bloody use it. I'm glad we're talking about early childhood education, not just childcare. And I used the word childcare deliberately before as a bit of a pejorative of, you know, chuck kids into childcare and go to work. Early childhood education is so incredibly valuable. The things that kids learn, I think I've given a shout out before, but if I haven't, Thrive by Five is a program run by Jay Weatherill, the ex-South Australian Prime Minister, funded by Twiggy's Mindaroo Foundation, for what it's worth. Not that that matters, but just it's pretty cool he's doing some of this stuff. The opportunity and the disadvantage that's kind of built in before kids get to five is phenomenal, and it very rarely gets undone. And if you can, if we can as a society help kids, you know, we talk about kids as if they're, you know, property of their parents. I think the very least society we owe our children is a fair, reasonable start in life. And that the evidence is pretty clear that happens before five. You know, primary school's good, but it's too late. If there are disadvantage built in or learning difficulties or issues or just simply to start low, you know, low reading, low vocabulary, those things don't tend to go away over time. So the value of early childhood education specifically, whether you have educators who are designing programs and teaching kids through play, it shouldn't be school, but teaching them through play, I think is spectacularly important. It is the very first thing I would fund in any budget, quite honestly, is appropriate amounts of early childhood education, not so women can go to work, not so blacks can go to work, so kids can get the best start in life. I just think it's a no-brainer for me.
I'll extend that too, and I know it's a point I often make, but and it's a small one, but probably an important one. We talk about things costing money, and I think when you look at the budget, there are things that cost money, but there are other things that I would just reframe it slightly and say, no, that's an investment. So yeah, money is going out the door, but I would define an investment as one where you expect more to come back in the future. So if I'm just giving you a stimulus check because I feel as though that's just going to help you and make you happy and vote for me. That's a one-off sugar hit, and that's nice. And okay, we can probably talk about multiplier effects and the rest of it. But generally speaking, it'd be hard to call it an investment.
Yep.
Whereas if you put the same dollar for dollar out there on a bridge or a road or something that actually will generate huge economic value down the track, that's a different thing.
Correct.
It shouldn't always just be spoken of in how much money have we spent, have we allocated. I'm far more interested in how we have invested that money. And this is just investment 101, wherever there is a positive and attractive return on investment capital, really, as long as there's fiscal capability, we should be throwing as much as humanly possible at that.
Yep, correct.
And that, to your point, that's early education full stop, is a wonderful example of that because we can put a bunch of money out the door now to help a bunch of 2, 3, 4, 5-year-olds. And that is not going to help society for another 20 years. But, you know, combined with a really, really good general education system, public education system, dare I say, the return on investment is phenomenal because we just have a cohort, a demographic of highly educated, capable people. What is that going to do for the country, right? Insane rates of return.
I think I could rant on a tangent on a rant on a tangent, but I won't, other than to say I completely agree with you. So that was they were probably the two big ones. This affordable housing thing, I think, is a complete fig leaf. You know, maybe the government does end up using bully pulpits, use the levers of government to make other people do other things. And if they do, I'd have no problem with that conceptually. But pretending this is a government commitment to 1 million houses is a bit of a, you know, it's like, we're going to lean on super funds and we're going to lean on this and we're going to try and make that. We're going to lean on the states. And I think there's, you know, there's a little bit of money. I mean, a lot of money in absolute dollars, but in the budget sense, bugger all cash from the federal government. And they're announcing a plan for 1 million homes. I mean, look, you know, if they want to and they can and they do, and that's all fine. But you know, it's one of those announcements you get to make when you're. It's like saying, you know, we're going to create this many new jobs. Like, well, no, the population's going to grow. It's going to happen anyway. Like, you know, there's no yeah. great. You know, so the economy's going to grow. Yes, that's what it does. You know, they're kind of empty promises. So there may be justification for it. They may even happen, but you got to back out what would have happened already, and then look at who's actually doing it, because it's not a government program. If you just simply say, "Hey, you lot over there, you make some houses,"
There's devil in the detail there too. I think it was only 20,000 affordable homes.
Yeah, that's right.
And it's really just drops in the ocean.
Yep, yep.
I think letting super in on that is just such a terrible idea.
Yeah, I agree.
The point, look, the thing is, and you will, these institutions will operate according to their mandate, mm-hmm. as they should,
yep.
which is to preserve and grow the capital of their investors. And so yep. they're not going to do anything. In fact, they shouldn't do anything without an attractive mm-hmm. rate of return mm-hmm. on that. Mm-hmm. But just by so allowing them in to play in this space, or encouraging them to, I mean, they're not going to do it. Well, they shouldn't, in fact, even do it if there's not going to be a good rate of return. But this is kind of a problem that is so pernicious that we actually need someone, probably the only institution that can do it is government, to say that actually we're happy not to make a good return on this because there is a huge problem here. And I would again frame it in the terms of investment, because I mean, look at some young kid whose mum was in social housing, who then became the prime minister.
Yeah, right.
You know, if they were living out of their car, that never would have happened. So there are, again, the most important thing you can do, really, for people who are struggling, is make sure you have a roof over your head. Because if you don't have that, then there's like almost everything else is a waste. So it's sort of huge, huge benefits. And people often like frame it as, oh, giving, you know, stuff for nothing and the rest mm-hmm. of it. But it's just, I think it's a very cynical kind of view on it. So anyway, I agree with you, mate. I think I one area of the budget, when I saw the headlines, they're doing a lot more for housing, I thought that is great. But then I think when you pick into it, it's like absolutely bugger all.
We'll get back to finance at some point. But this is financially relevant, right? My biggest bugbear with the housing thing is, I think there's something like 8 or 9 million houses in Australia, something like that. I think that's roughly the number. Building 10% more, 11% more, 12% more is an interesting idea. I am far from convinced that we've done the other work, which is, can the natural environment and the built environment handle that change? Does a society want and can it handle that change? Even simple things. I have family members who, and I won't name them because I don't get them in trouble, who work in and around urban planning and other things. And some of the developments that are being built now are technically too much for things like the sewage system. Like, we just literally, they're saying that the number of residences we have and the size of the pipes that take our effluent from here to there, it's, you know, we're asking for trouble X years down the track when these all get built and people move in. And so I think it's all fine to say that. I don't know what the answer is. I have a feeling it's got to do with sprawl or something. It's probably got to do with density somewhere. I think it's actually got to do with population as well. I don't know how we solve that particular riddle, because population has been used for years to keep economic growth going. It, you know, kind of maintains the facade of growth. If you have a, you know, GDP that's growing by 10%, even if you have 15% more people, obviously per person we're going backwards, but it looks better on the numbers. And there's not some value in that, by the way. It's not nothing. But I'm just not sure that building a million houses is the answer without having those other conversations about what can the country stand. We're already talking about raising the Warragamba Dam wall in Sydney. Are the dams being built or not built? Who's in power around the rest of the country? It just strikes me that we are heading in one single direction without really having that conversation about what the built environment, the natural environment, and the infrastructure that we already have in place can actually handle.
I mean, you are 1,000% correct. Yeah, you see these developments go up and they're right on top of each other. There's not a tree in sight. There's one road out. there's you know, they don't have the schools, the hospitals.
Floodplains as well, by the way.
Do you know? I feel as though, again, maybe I'm being a little bit cynical, but it's just sort of like no one's thought beyond the peripheral, and they've allowed sort of the fox into the hen house when having these conversations, which is you start talking to developers like, oh yeah, we can build you a gazillion houses, for what's in our interest to build as much as we can with the land that we've got. You know, we don't make any money by having there is much more money to be made with super high density than there is with something that might be a bit more nice, spread out, that has a lot more facilities around it. We just make less. And so it's kind of, It's very, very, very first order thinking. Mm. And yeah, I think we're seeing that in a lot of places too. We're just all the schools are over capacity, hospitals are over capacity, the roads are full. Like you've got to, it's a holistic planning, a plan that is required.
Mm-hmm. Yep, I think that's right. Mate, let's move on a little bit. Look, I think so bottom line, it's an interesting budget. It's a placeholder budget. It probably should have made a press release. You know, we're going to do what we said we're going to do. Things are tough. We'll see you next time. As you say, those forecasts from Treasury became the focal point almost because there was no other big news that became the news, which is not Chalmers' fault. It's not even wrong. It just was what it was. There is another budget due in May when we get back into regular budget cycles. Stage 3 tax cuts will be back on the agenda. We're not going to talk about those today because we've done that well and truly enough. You know my views. You know Andrew's views on that. But it was the one thing they didn't address after flagging it. You know, they kind of put the flag up a couple of weeks ago and went, oops, nope, doesn't sound like that's a good idea. Let's not do that. The deficit question more broadly, though, which is the last one I want to finish on with the budget, is, and again, I've said this before, but it bears repeating, and frankly, until I'm blue in the face, you can't continue to run massive budget deficits on an ongoing basis and expect the economy in the country to be able to continue to pay its bills, to be a worthy creditor, to be someone people want to lend money to. If you're an MMT fan, I don't want to hear from you. Not that I don't love you, just the whole thing is not a magic pudding as they would like to believe. Oh, that's going to make them mad. You can't keep running those sort of deficits. That you have to pay the piper, even under MMT, frankly, and I'm not going to get into it. Modern monetary theory, for those who are wondering, someone pays the piper, right? So there's no magic theory under which money becomes all of a sudden accessible without consequence. By definition, it doesn't work. Money is a...
It's almost as if we need some kind of ultra-hard money that's tamper-proof.
No, we don't need that. What we do need is we need the ability to actually borrow and spend. That's the beauty of Keynesian economics. But the pay the debt back thing is the cost of that debt is going through the roof right now and will continue to do so. So that's the first thing. Second thing is when we want to go and borrow more money next time, someone's going to say, well, you've already got a lot of debt. And you already mentioned, you know, there's issues around the debt we have and how much we do or don't have and all that kind of stuff. That's important. So knowing what that's going to cost is an issue. My firm belief is that we run the best country we can, including, by the way, not leaving our kids a basket case by having a structurally balanced budget over time. That's not totally balanced and it's not every year. It's structurally balanced. That means if you're going to spend a bit of extra money in the downtimes, you want to make that money back in the good times so that we have an even keel over time. Why? Because A, I don't want to leave debt for the kids. B, I want to be a good debtor as a country, not because I care about a reputation, though I do, but because we want to be able to access those markets next time, right? How much money keeps... Probably the Yanks are probably fine because the dollar's the reserve currency. The Yanks are probably borrowed for a million years. At some point, i.e. the UK, you know, that's what happens when you screw this stuff up. When the market loses confidence in your ability to pay your debts, that's what happens. So... the lack of, and this is not the current government's fault solely. The last government came into power, talking about debt and deficit disasters, and then completely threw the rule book out, partly because of COVID and partly fair enough. But they have no plan post that to pay the debt back. The Labor Party have come to power with no plan. Not only to pay the debt back, just to get it back in a balance, stop adding to the debt in the first place. I just find the whole thing really, really discouraging. It is a symptom of our politics, unfortunately. I think they can spend and spend and spend and not worry about paying it back. And I, for one, don't want to leave that sort of mess to my kids.
It seems to me, again, I'm being cynical, but politically inevitable, because when we're going through the good times, a mining boom, for example, we're just flush with cash. Mm. And, you know, I want to get reelected. Mm. I look at the Treasury. Wow, we're overflowing. Mm. Let's spend some money. Mm. Let's spend some cash. Like, why wouldn't I? Right. Yep. So I've got less, I don't really have much of an incentive to not spend it. In fact, I've got a massive incentive to spend it.
Exactly.
Right. And then we inevitably, the cycle changes and then we're in a tough time. Mm-hmm. And then politically, everyone say, well, do what you have to do because it's a crisis and we need to spend. And so you've got the political green light to go ahead and do that.
Correct.
And again, as you, to your point, you probably should during those times. It's just that it's not balanced out at the other side. So the you get a ratcheting effect where it just goes up and up and up and up and up. And to your point, it makes sense. Why would the interest rate go up under a scenario like that? Because people who are lending money to the government, i.e. people who are buying the sovereign bonds, aren't idiots. And they are looking at the situation. And this is exactly what happened with the UK gilts. After the trust budget, because they thought, well, whoa, wait a second, this is really bad. you might be able to pay me back, but you'll be paying me back with highly diluted pounds. This is not good. So in much the same way as if you looked at lending money to two people and one was very, very reliable, very productive,
very
trustworthy, well, you would lend to them at a much lower interest rate than someone who's like a meth addict. Like you're going to. Apologies to our meth addict listeners out there. No offense intended.
That's both groups now. The old people and the meth addicts. We're going to have no listeners left at the end of the week.
But you know what I mean? Like it's just, it's really, it's so easy to overcomplicate a lot of these high finance things, but it really just comes back to some very, very basic kind of considerations. And so you make an excellent point.
As always, thank you. I appreciate it. And look, you know, I said they left it by the last government. It is a bipartisan debacle because neither party has a plan for this. They've just simply forgotten that fiscal discipline matters, which is matters.
But again, it's a question of incentives. Let's say that you or any particular political party and you come and say, actually, this is a mess. I'm going to fix it up. Oh, by the way, there's less money for you and I'm going to tax you more. But don't worry, it's going to be really good for the country over the next 10 to 20 years. I mean, you're gone. I have no idea how you solve that problem, but that's kind of at the heart of the problem because we need an adult in the room to make some we need some tough love. As a country, we need some tough love. And just as you know, I would love to be able to say to my kids, you know what, have sugar for breakfast, lunch, and dinner. And here you go, here's an iPad, just watch that all day, every day. They would love me. They would think I was fantastic. Is it good for them? No. That's kind of the scenario we're in just generally in politics, unfortunately.
Yep. We also probably have to take some personal responsibility on that one too, mate. We need an adult in the room, but we also need to be adults ourselves. And, you know, JFK's "That's not what your country can do for you" kind of rings pretty true 60-odd years later. Hey, let's move on a little bit, not too far actually, but let's go to inflation because that was the poor old Treasury. The ink wasn't even dry on the budget papers when the forecast of 7.75% as the maximum inflation peak that the Treasury is expecting before it starts to fall again. They announced that on Tuesday evening, 7:30, the budget papers were released to the public. By 11:30 the next morning, the ABS had said, actually, turns out September inflation was 7.3%. Now, that's not 7.75. Treasury are still in the game. There's still a chance. As they say, you're saying there's a chance. There's still a chance they could actually pull this one out. Maybe inflation peaks here and falls, or maybe they look like geniuses, or not. And there's a real risk that, you know, as I said, less than 24 hours later, those forecasts, they're good forecasts by good people who are trying their best. As we've said many, many times, mate, forecasts and predictions are pretty much worth exactly what you pay for them, unless you're paying for them, in which case they're worth a whole lot less. Just because no one knows, right? It is what it is. But I just thought it was an interesting juxtaposition. More importantly, CPI, the inflation numbers are terrible and terrible in absolute black and white numbers, but terrible in terms of the impact they're having on the economy. We've talked before about this. It takes away purchasing power. You said, you know, it steals money out of your bank account. Effectively, that's exactly what it does do.
And
makes everything more expensive. Right, exactly. Yep. It makes everything more expensive. All that stuff is true. The central banks don't have a choice. There's no third door, as I've said before. There's rates and inflation, and you can kind of choose the mix of those two. But if there's no, let's just do the thing where neither of those things happens. It doesn't exist, right? We have to get through this one way or the other. Food inflation, 9%. Housing construction, 10.5% year on year. I think that was the highest of the numbers. They're all positive. They're all up, increases. So things are getting worse, mate. The quarterly number was 1.8%. If you want to be generous, you say you're waiting, well, is that only 7.2%? So maybe, you know, Treasury might just pull it out of the fire. And they might, by the way. Again, I'm not making predictions because the first they didn't do it beforehand. I don't think anyone should. It's crazy to imagine where it might finish. But it was worse than the market thought. I think it's worse than the RBA probably thought. It's worse than what Treasury thought. The bad news, I think, is that that probably also means that rates are going to have to go up higher or for longer than what they were originally going to. I think on Tuesday, if you'd asked the RBA, they would have said, oh, whatever curve they might have drawn on their heads, they never released these things. Whatever they might have done on their heads, oh, it would roughly look like this. I got to say, by Wednesday morning, they went, okay, it's going to have to be a little bit higher than it was. Is that a fair assumption?
Yeah, absolutely. A 32-year high. And they have this thing called the trimmed inflation measure, which gets rid of some of the more volatile items. Mm-hmm. And you know, some of those more volatile items are pretty important to your spending, such as fuel and the rest of it. Right. But they are volatile. So mm-hmm. they do kind of like to look at them without those to mm-hmm. sort of see through that. But what was interesting, even on the trimmed basis, it was 6.1%. So this is very broad-based inflation. The Aussie dollar, as we know, has come back a good 15% or so this year. So there's everything that we import is 15% more expensive.
That's the big one you don't always see.
You don't always see that kind of stuff. There are interest rate differentials as well. Mm. So there's what other countries are doing very much matter. So it's kind of like, well, we don't live in America, but what the Fed is doing is very impactful for us. Mm. And they're just going at it hammer and tongs. So the more that they go up, the more the differential is there, the more people are going to take money out here and put it over there. There's all of these factors. And the bottom line is just like, well, so what? Well, so what is your mortgage is going to get a lot more expensive is the so what.
Well, also, and the one part is you're paying more. Sorry, just
quickly on that. Not only is it getting expensive in sort of nominal terms, but in real terms, it's even more expensive because of the inflation, you know.
That's what I was going to say. When you're paying both, that's the other thing. It's not, you know, so if you've got a mortgage and you actually are breathing, then you're paying higher prices at the shops and then you're paying more to the bank. Yeah, because of those higher prices, it is a brutally cruel system when it goes badly.
The debt level itself is going down in real terms. There's one silver lining of high inflation. So you're eventually you're paying back. The debt is being sort of inflated away.
With one exception, which is just that, unless you're getting more wages as a result, then you're not really benefiting from that. So it's you need to think about debt in the context of the take home pay, not the price of lettuce or lumber.
Yep. So it's a problem, and the narrative started as it's transitory. Mm. Oh, okay. It's not so transitory. Oh, it'll peak at a lower level. Mm. Oh, it'll turn. And it's just like every single point, it has been wrong so far. Mm. So maybe a lot of this ends up being true. I mean, look, my thumbsuck guess, and it's totally that, is that we will see it roll over at some point. But I think the days of 2-3% inflation are long gone. For a whole bunch of structural reasons, so and as you say, it's an intractable problem. I historically, if you want to look at historically, how have we gotten out of this? Well, not easily is the question. The best scenario, I've said this before, the best possible scenario is we have some productivity boom.
Yes,
maybe AI, or something like that. It's like someone invents the 21st century equivalent of the steam engine. Mm-hmm. And then we just grow our way out of it. Yeah. So in other words, we can deal with it because we're producing so much more with what we've got.
Yep.
But that's kind of the only, it's a bit of a Hail Mary perhaps.
It is, although it is the missing link of the last 20 years as well. And there's definitely a linkage between those two things. Mm-hmm. It's brutal, mate. It's brutal. And it's not going anytime soon. I think there is no good outcome. And back to the budget. That's why Jim Chalmers didn't add more pressure to that inflation number, because it would have just made things worse. Mm-hmm. But inflation is going to be with us for a while. I would actually, so here, just for fun, I will disagree with you 100% on whether inflation gets back to between 2-3%. I will say it absolutely will. And actually not because I think it will, speaking of predictions and forecasts before, but new normals are really new normals. And so I would just bet, like people who said inflation was dead and then it's not. And the people say, well, I won't go back to normal. I think it probably will. Again, it could be entirely wrong.
What kind of time? What time frame are we talking?
You said eventually.
If you say 30 years, then I'll probably agree with you. But.
Oh, I would say it'll be below 3% on a quarterly basis, easily within 3 years. Five years. I meant three.
Okay.
Years.
Okay.
We'll see. Anyway, yeah. Mate. Look, that's probably enough on inflation. let's go to the third horseman of the apocalypse. How many companies are there that haven't had a cyber attack in the last 24 hours? Because I'm running out of fingers to count the ones that have. I said 24 hours. I'm being flippant. But we've had Optus, we've had Medibank, we've had Australian Clinical Labs, MyDeal, which is the website owned by Woolworths. I'm not a conspiracist, mate, but there's a lot of coincidence in a very short amount of time. To imagine there's no the chance that someone somewhere is orchestrating this, I can't imagine is exactly zero. Whether there's something or someone behind it or not, I don't know. Whether it's just dumb luck and a whole lot of kids who are bored and happen to have some time on their hands, I don't know either. But either way, I mean, look, it's a thing. I'm no cybersecurity expert, so I'm not going to try and weigh in on that necessarily. from an investing perspective, I kind of think it's one of those things you've got to go, it'll happen at some point to a company I own and the shares will probably fall, but what else do you do? Like I was thinking about, you know, Medibank, if you're a Medibank private shareholder, a week and a half ago, you weren't thinking, you know what, on my list of the 10 biggest, 15, 20 biggest risks that might cause a 16% drop in my shares, one of the top 20 is the chance of a cyber attack. I mean, it's always possible. If someone said, could it possibly? Yeah, maybe it'll happen. Sure, maybe. Mm. You wouldn't have put it at the top of your list for MyDeal, for Medibank, for Optus, for Australian Clinical Labs. Maybe we should. But I'm also not sure what else you do as an investor. Maybe you wait till it happens and then you buy the shares. Maybe the capitulation trade. Maybe it's the, you know, they can't get much worse than that. Once Medibank's had a hack, I'll buy their shares. And I'll wait for someone else to be hacked and I'll buy their shares. And maybe that's how you trade this one. I don't know. Thoughts on cyber attacks, thoughts on cybersecurity, thoughts on investing in that sort of world?
Well, they are a big deal. They're a very big deal, as we have seen, not just in the impact it has to customers. And I think I'm a customer of most of those names that you mentioned. So I am 100% having my identity stolen.
Oh, dear.
So that's really the first.
P-A-G. No, okay.
Mother's maiden name, date of birth, rah, rah, rah. I think there's a couple things. Firstly, risk builds slowly and it happens suddenly. I think it's something to really bear in mind. These things don't come out of, this is stuff that has been brewing for a long, long, long time. And it just be, to properly protect your data requires a bit of vigilance, requires a bit of spend, requires a bit of focus, but no one's doing it because there's always five other burning platforms as a management team that you have to sort of look at. And it's costing you money today for something that isn't a problem today, or certainly not perceived as a problem today. So I absolutely see why it's happened. You'd be surprised at the age and sophistication of some of the big IT systems that companies are using.
Yeah. Man, that probably makes it unhackable, right? Because they don't even connect to the internet anymore. It's like, I don't know how to get it. I think who can, you know, no hackers know how to hack in C++, right? Or COBOL or something, or BASIC.
It's legacy issues, right? Because these are big, big systems built up over decades. Yeah. And then you think, okay, well, let's add this to it. And they're sort of, it becomes an absolute mess. Often the best thing is to do is just tear it all down and build it again, but no one's going to do that. That is a huge, complicated project full of its own kind of problems. So this is just the world that we live in. I think there's probably needs to be some kind of policy response. Not that I'm a person who thinks government can fix everything, far from it, but I do think that a lot of these companies are collecting data because there are certain KYC, or know your client rules, and the rest of it. Mm-hmm. So I think we need to have a more mature look at what is absolutely necessary.
Yeah, that's a good point.
For a company to keep, and what it should keep after the fact, because a lot of this data is for people who haven't been a customer for years and years and years.
Yeah.
And so I think that is going to sort of we need to add a little bit of a stick approach to it as well, sort of saying that actually, as a company, you need to collect certain data just to do your business, but you don't need potentially as much as you've got, and you certainly don't need to keep it after the fact. Yeah,
it's hard,
but it's going
right?
to cost big bickies to mediate.
It really is. I find this difficult only in the sense that, like always, we look back at things and go, you know what they should have done back then? They should have done this thing. And right now, there's a thing being done, whatever that thing is, that's going to hurt us in 6 or 12 months' time. It's probably not the last thing, because it's a bit like, you know, again, generals fighting the last war, right? By the time you've got your defenses ready for the last thing that happened, the next thing is the thing that surprised you, because it actually doesn't, you know. And I wonder how much protection we need to make over the last thing versus the next thing, and how to think that through. And frankly, the crises could have been different, right? I imagine there's a different crisis where Optus is taken to court by the ACCC or APRA or somebody and says, you prove to me that you did your know your client checks properly. I know we deleted all that information. You deleted that information? How can you possibly do your job? Haven't you seen what happened with the casinos? You should be keeping all this information so I can, you know. And I, you're not wrong. You're absolutely not wrong. But I do think we, and this is not about you at all or me or whatever, but we all respond to the last thing and say, the last thing could have been prevented if this hadn't happened. And you know, again, in a different circumstance, we're saying they should keep more information because that way they can prove they've got the information. If they can't prove it, how can you possibly say you're doing this stuff? Again, I don't know the answer. I'm not suggesting. Maybe I'm being devil's advocate just because I can or just because it's fun. But it just does strike me that we all look at the very last thing and say, you shouldn't be doing that thing. when you know the next problem is likely to be different, or the last problem could have been an entirely different issue on the same data set in this case. And we would have said, well, you should have something different then. So yeah, otherwise this thing wouldn't have happened. How do you do both? I think you're right about the mature conversation. It's a common theme across this podcast. Ironically speaking of you and I, but you know, about the sort of rules that we should be having and what should be kept in place, and how we should do those sort of jobs to make sure we're all in good places. I do wonder. The other thing is, you know, the government's increased the fine to $50 million for people get companies get hacked, and I guess you've got to, because the government, so you've got to be shown to be seen to be doing something, so the opposition can't say you're not doing anything about this. You don't care about the Australian consumer, and they all do it to each other. It's not a party political view, just, you know, change the label on the back of their jackets and the same thing happens, right? Same words come out of the mouths. I mean, look, it's probably justified. It's probably okay. Medibank Private lost $1.8 billion in market cap. So can I tell you, they don't really give a stuff about the $50 million fine either way. It's kind of insult to injury, right? But that's not where the issue is. And frankly, I'd imagine they'll lose more than $50 million in profit between, you know, the remediation work, God knows how many thousand cybersecurity experts they're going to have in that business. They're going to be holding new office buildings at Medibank where they, you know, house thousands of these people to try and make sure nothing happens next time. All that stuff's kind of going on. $50 million fine, sure. And I think, look, if they were abjectly negligent, I get it. I think we've talked about this before. But I don't reckon anyone at Medibank's going, should we fix that? No, bugger it. No one's ever going to find that. You know, they're going, have we done all the work? Yes, we've done all the work. CIO, the chief information officer says, yep, or technology officer, we've done all this stuff. Yes, we've done the tests. We've had this consulting firm, that consulting firm. They've done the work. Yes, we're complete. As far as we can tell, we're fine. And you get hacked. And it's like, well, I don't know. That's what I mean about the investing thing, mate. I'm almost just trying to wonder whether this is just the new normal. Like, is this just, you know, almost by definition, it's like wars themselves. You're looking for, you're probing for a hole in the lines somewhere. And no general leaves a hole in the lines deliberately. They do their level best with the resources they've got to make sure everything's okay. I don't know, should they do anything differently? Do they, can they?
Well, there's no silver bullet. I'm not a systems engineer, but I have heard it said that every system is potentially hackable.
What's kind of that? Almost by definition, right? Yeah.
Yeah. So there's a huge spectrum there. You know, like in the case of Optus, where you just left an API public access point open. You know, like I'm trying to think of the thing. What's it called? Henlon's razor. Never attribute to malice that which is adequately explained by stupidity. You know,
that's almost the thing. It's like that. To your point, this is going to happen. Like I don't know what else.
There is a spectrum. So there is a big difference between someone who has looked at it, taken it seriously, and taken a lot of steps to mitigate that as much as possible, versus someone who's like, eh, we kind of give it a brief look. Right. How do you tell that from, to your original point? How do you tell that from the outside as an investor? I don't know. This is the silver lining of all of the stuff that's happening. Is I can bet every corporate in the country is like they're having meetings right now saying right,
they're doing nothing else. That's right. Wolves are going out of stock on the shelves because they're worried about the website. Exactly.
This is one of the things we very rationally want to do as investors is we want to try and eliminate all the risk. And I think one of the very bitter pills that we all have to swallow is it's impossible. You can't. I mean, you are first principles here. Investing is making a bet on the future, and you can't know the future, and you can't know. I mean, there's things that you know that you don't know, and the things that you don't know that you don't know, and all that.
Now you're telling Donald Rumsfeld.
Kind of stuff. So it's just, it will always be the case. No matter how smart you are, no matter how much due diligence you have done, you know, there will always be the quote unquote black swan kind of event that can come out and wipe you out. So what do you do, to your point? I think what you do is you accept it as an inevitable reality and you structure yourself in a way that you just... I mean, this is why you don't have all your eggs in one basket, no matter how attractive that basket is.
That's right.
There's some really simple things you can do, just like concepts that are as old as time that will at least mitigate that. So when something comes out of left field, it's like, that really sucks, you know? I'm okay. And also being... forgiving of yourself. I was speaking to a friend the other day who, I don't know if anyone follows Codan. They had a really shocker of a day yesterday. They sell metal detectors, and Sedan is a basket case at the moment, and the big part of their sales go there. So just really very fluid situation, changed rapidly. And so all of a sudden their sales have just plummeted in that region.
Yeah.
And he's like, oh, I should have known. I should have been able to see this. Like, dude, you could never have seen that. Like, yeah. Just accept there are when I'm looking at times I have lost money in a particular investment, and believe you me, there's plenty of those things. Mm. There are those that I can, with objective hindsight, say that was a mistake. I didn't do this. I didn't look at that. Mm. But also, and this isn't just trying to protect the ego, there are actually a lot of situations where it's like, well, actually, I couldn't have seen that. It comes into that category of the unknown unknown. It was did it happen? Yes. Did it suck? Yes. Could have I reasonably foreseen that and taken action against that? Actually, no. Not really. I mean, it seems obvious in hindsight.
Yeah. Yep.
But you know, you couldn't. And that's, I think when those kinds of things happen, that's where you need to recognize what has happened, whether it was as a mistake, whatever your initial thinking was, whatever your loss is, actually doesn't really matter. The question is, well, what do I do from here? And try to frame it in that way. I listened to a really great podcast the other day with Stanley Druckenmiller, who I mentioned before is probably one of the greatest investors of all time. 30-year history, incredible double-digit returns, never had a down year. Never had a down year, which is just phenomenal. Mm. And his key, one of the many strengths I think he has as an investor is that ability to detach the emotion. Mm-hmm. And this is a theme that you'll see. And no matter, insert your preferred famous investor here. And they all have different styles. They all have different sort of nuggets of wisdom. But one thing that I think is common across all of them is that ability to remove that emotion and to act objectively. And I think this is just a good example of all of that. It'll happen to you at some stage, whether it's through a cyber attack or something else. Dust yourself off. Okay, that sucked. Move on. The wrong lesson that too many people take, particularly who are new to it, they experience something like this and they go, oh, I knew it's all rigged. It sucks. I'm never doing that again. Mm. And then they don't invest, thinking that it has to be a game of very high strike rates to do well, which as we both know, it's not the case. 6 out of 10 in this game, in a strike rate, you can do extraordinarily well.
Very, very good advice.
Motley Fool Money. For more, subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener.
Mate, I want to do something very, very different. I'm always mindful of being careful to not be too, I don't know, I don't become a cliche of myself. I don't become a caricature of myself. But let's go back and talk about coal companies one more time. I won't say one last time because we'll be back here, but one more time. And I'm also mindful I'm going to be critical. And I just want to be, you know, again, I have a view, I've expressed a view on that sort of stuff. And, you know, I might be right, I might be wrong. Whitehaven Coal has had an extraordinary run. I'm pretty sure we talked about this before in different ways, shapes, and forms. The shares have just, it's phenomenally good. This is a company that, I'm looking back at the numbers now, in September 2020, the shares were 90 cents. At the time of recording, they are now $9.50. That's a tenfold 10X. Gain in less, or just over 2 years. Man, you know, for all of the coal's dead, the environment's changing, renewables are the future. If you'd ignore that, well, Whitehaven shares, you've done remarkably well. I haven't. I didn't. But it has done remarkably, remarkably well. Two things during the week. Whitehaven's paying its CEO more than it otherwise would. And it actually says, we're doing this because no one wants to work here. We are non-ESG. We are, you know, cool kids don't want to work here. We got to pay more to get people to come and work for us because they just, you know, it's not sort of like, if you Google, you pay people peanuts and they will kill each other to work there. Whitehaven, you know, you've almost got to knock them down, drag them out, you know, chain gang style, literally Shanghai them and put them on the boat and sail off into the distance. So they're saying they are paying more to the executives because they just simply have to get good quality people who otherwise could work somewhere else and feel, frankly, less guilty, I suppose, is what they're admitting, even if they're not saying it. The other thing they announced during the week is they're going to do a share buyback. Now, I don't know about you, mate. I do know about you, actually, but I'm going to let me continue with the fiction. I don't know about you, but if my share price is at or near an all-time high, it's come back a little bit, by the way. It actually topped out at $10.80. No, $10.96, almost 11 bucks, only a few weeks ago. Shares are up tenfold. They're almost at effectively record highs, call it close enough. The coal price out of the Port of Newcastle, it is a record high. And the company's saying, you know what, the best use of our cash is to buy our own shares. Now, I have a view, And look, I think here's the thing. It's always hard to make these decisions because you don't know what happens in the future, right? If Whitehaven Coal shares are $100 a share in 5 years' time, what I'm about to say makes me look like the biggest idiot in the world. If they're 90 cents, I look like an absolute genius, and we can't know for sure. And we shouldn't, I say all-time highs, the chart, you know, you shouldn't use charts for this stuff. You know, Berkshire Hathaway shares have been at all-time highs. Amazon shares have been at all-time highs. I own both those two businesses for long periods of time. And what did they do? They went higher. So I want to be careful about saying all-time highs are bad. And we've said, you and I've said before, buying after shares have gone up is sometimes the hardest but best thing to do.
Mm.
But this is a cyclical commodity where everything is at the top of its range. And if you've got cyclical things at the top of their range, cycles being cycles, I'm going to spec. Let me put my neck on the line here. I think buying back Whitehaven shares at $9.50 is suboptimal. Courageous, as they would say in Yes Minister. I think it is a dumb thing to do because maybe they're right, and maybe they've lost some value. But we've talked so much about investing being a probability based game. Probabilistically, if you've got an all time high on the coal price, an all time high on the share price, and you're in a cyclical industry, it's a very good chance if you buy back shares now, you're going to be massively overpaying. Or am I completely wrong?
You're not wrong based on the way you've laid it out. And as you say, it depends. I'll play devil's advocate.
Yeah,
just to play devil's advocate. So, you know, if you look at their history of earnings, you know, they've actually had quite a few years of loss in there. There hasn't been a consistent march upwards. It's sort of just sort of, yeah, okay, but nothing mind-blowing. Mm. 2022, per share earnings, $1.95, just well above what they'd ever done over the last 10 years, and that's as far back as the data on my screen goes at this point in time. Then I look at the forecast. So these are forecasts, so take them with a grain of salt, but the analysts that cover it are saying that it should be close enough to $4 per share in 2023. Now, shares are trading at $9.86.
Mm.
So on a forward basis, based on FY 2023, the PE is 2.
Yeah.
So the argument could go here is like, what are you talking about, Scott? These aren't expensive shares. These are super, super, super cheap.
Yeah.
However,
and they could be. And they could be.
They now also just like it turns out that on the figures I'm looking at, and again, this is just based on a consensus view of the analysts that happen to cover it, and analysts are humans and are often wrong, et cetera, et cetera. But they're saying, well, in FY24, that's going to halve. That goes from $4 down to $2 and then down to $1.64 in 2025.
Mm.
So they are at least recognizing that this is a cyclical peak. Mm. So an incredible couple of years of super profits, and then things will start to moderate back to, well, they'll probably mean revert might be a good term to sort of use there.
Mean revert, mean being average, revert being go back to. So simply things tend to go back to their average.
It tends to be the way for certain types of metrics. PE is a good one like that. So anyway, the even under that, even if I go, well, okay, I'm going to take FY25's forecast of $1.64 at face value.
Mm.
And I quickly plug onto my calculator. It's still a PE of 6. So where you're potentially wrong, and this is assuming the analysts are right, et cetera, et cetera, is that perhaps it is kind of cheap.
Mm.
So I guess that is the bet here.
Funny though, they weren't buying shares back at 90 cents.
Yes.
You know, and it should have been in theory equally as cheap, unless they say, but we couldn't have told the future, in which case I'll say, yes. Exactly. Yes. That's the bit that, you know, it's if you buy back the whole way along because you were so sure this was a great business and great shares, you know, and it was going to be even worth even more, they should have mortgaged the entire thing to buy back shares at 90 cents. I mean, they got it with a tenfold gain. If the future was that bright and that attractive, they shouldn't have been doing it then too, right?
You're right. So that's the point here. So like it might be that FY 2025, you know, someone's just cracked cold fusion and there's a suitcase that you can put a glass of water in that powers Sydney for 1,000 years, you know. So who knows what it be, and in which case they're probably zero at that point, and this is the most ridiculous thing that's ever happened.
Just so we're clear, did you say 1,000 years?
It's 1,000 if you prefer.
Let's go with that.
I did say 1,000 years. The other thing I would say, just as a separate point, is that it's always predicated on this notion that we are returning funds to shareholders. And it's a small bugbear of mine, but it's a bugbear nonetheless. The only money you're returning to shareholders are those that participate in the buyback.
Yeah.
Everyone else ostensibly gets extra value because it's the opposite of dilution. It's a concentration of shares. So mm-hmm. you've got a greater ownership, but no capital has been returned to you. Let's just be clear on that. Mm. If you really want to put money into my pockets, you could do that via a dividend. Mm. Now, they may be looking at their franking balance and go, well, we just don't have enough to do it. Mm. So we can only issue unfranked dividends. Frankly, there are worse punishments in the world than getting a huge dividend, even if it happens to be unfranked. That might be a more another way of distributing these super profits.
I don't know, mate. Given those choices, right? And if you are so sure the business is worth money, say to people, hey, guess what? We're going to give you a massive dividend. And by the way, for this dividend, we'll have a DRP, a dividend reinvestment plan, and you get a 10% discount on the share price.
But
if you really want to make that point,
best
right,
of both worlds.
There's a million ways you can do it. Now, I mean, the discount is, again, it's a bit of funny money because the people get, you know, the non-participants get diluted by the people who participate. But in any case, you could do it should you choose to. Should you try and make some way of saying, you know what, here's the money, but... and I think this is the real challenge is these companies got way too much cash right now.
Yeah.
New Hope, by the way, in the same basket, owned by Soul Patts. I own shares of Soul Patts. I don't own New Hope directly. And people are saying, gee, those coal miners are cheap. And it's kind of like they're cheap if they use this cash, they're getting really, really well. These are windfall profits and you can choose to do a whole lot of stuff. If you go and dig more coal mines or buy more coal mines or, you know, coal mining sites, you are betting that the future of coal remains bright. If you are, you know, buying other businesses, you are hoping those businesses diversify your earnings or add to your earnings over time. If you buy your shares back, if you pay, these all have absolute consequences. And to believe, I will say, probably be, against, you know, reasonable belief, that you can actually do that and make some money. I don't know, mate. It just strikes me that if you weren't buying back the shares already, you got the cash, fine. But you got the cash because the earnings are unusually and whatever high. By the way, if they're right, these things, to your point, this is a scream we all should be buying now. Mm. I mean, that's the thing, right? No one's buying 90 cents. Everyone's buying $10. But it's also, I don't know, when everyone gets that excited about something, the little contrarian in me says, we've been here before, graphene, lithium, Afterpay, you know, choose your preferred hype area. If I was a betting man, I'll look, put it this way, I'm not buying coal shares right now, and I'd be very, very, very happy if Soul Patts, for example, decided to find a buyer for its New Hope stake while the price was pretty high. I think that would strike me as the best use for the capital. But I'm no coal miner, so what do I know?
Yeah. I never say never, just a general rule, I don't go in this space. It tends to, like, really frustrate people who love going in this space. But, I mean, you know, we all got to play our own game here. Yeah. And I guess part of the reason, so I've got no problem with people doing, I know some, I've mentioned before, some really smart investors who've done really well in this space. So you do you is, I guess, what I'm saying. Please don't send me any nasty emails. But I guess one of the things I'm mindful of is just the diabolical difficulty of forecasting not only commodity prices, but what management and boards will do with excess cash when they have it. It's just very tricky. And generally speaking, you have to take that excess money and plow it into developing another mine because each day your mine gets less valuable because you're digging stuff out of it. So you've got to be replaced at some point. Developing mines are very, very, very expensive with very long payback periods. And that's fine. That's just the nature of the business. But it's also a very uncertain business because it usually costs more to build and develop than you think. There's often all kinds of environmental and other kinds of problems along the way. Mm-hmm. And then by the time you're ready and you're finally digging stuff out of the ground, the commodity scenario has radically changed, in which case the initial economics you predicated on could be completely different, could be completely worse, maybe completely better, but it's just I'm hyper aware of that. So I'm be watched with great curiosity from the sidelines.
I think that's very wise. I think that point about what you do with the money is just really, really important, right? Like you're getting this windfall profits and you can do anything you want with the cash. Returning it to shareholders, I think, makes some sense in terms of, hey, we've done really well. We can't find ways to use this money. Here it is back. Again, if they're right, if these shares are cheap, then this will be absolutely a great time to buy the shares. For $100 in 10 years' time, I look like an idiot, and that's wouldn't be the first time. So let's assume that that's possible. If you are in an industry like this where there is an uncertain future, and you have the opportunity to do anything else other than doubling down. Because that's what buying back shares just doubles down the existing holds, right? It basically says, hey, you still own your shares, great. You now own a bit more of the same business. with whatever the future of that business looks like. And if you love the business and you love the current share price, then sure. But if you're saying, look, I bought shares at Whitehaven Coal, I'm really stoked, I've made a lot of money. And I say, you're buying shares now? No, I'm not. Why not? Well, because the value's not obviously there. Either you're wrong and the company's right, which is absolutely possible, or it's not. And that's one of the big challenges. I think I'm going to say no. Just a quick one, mate, from you on the salary thing. Do you buy the, we've got to pay them more because no one wants to work here? It's a, you know, we've got to pay, I will say blood money. I'll say that with tongue in cheek because blood money is obviously different in different areas. But it does feel very much like that kind of, you know, I'd have to pay you X dollars to work anywhere else, but I've got to pay you X plus something because you've got to sleep at night.
Yeah, I mean, there is definitely some truth to it. You know, you see the same in the public service. They say, well, we need to pay this person this much money because otherwise they'll just go to the private sector and we won't have any talent. So there's always a modicum of truth to it. So it's not that the general concept is flawed. It's a question of degrees. And that's a much more difficult one. So the only way you would really know is via the counterfactual and say, actually, we're not going to give you a pay rise and see what happens.
Yeah, exactly.
Are you going to go? You know, we all like to sort of say, oh, well, I could get so much more money here. It's like I've seen it happen in other institutions. Like, all right, see you later, sunshine. Like, oh, well, you caught my bluff.
I've had a couple of experiences. The job I worked for just before joining The Fool was a business that wasn't one of the most highly regarded food businesses. Don't do anything dodgy at all, not even slightly. Just it was a big old slow business, and there was a, you know, I won't say war for talent, but it was pretty, you know. And so they were paying over the odds, and I actually left the current job I was then doing to join this company because they were offering meaningfully more for the same job. I was like, well, I'm not stupid. If you want to pay me more, they'll take it, sure. Turns out that I wasn't there 4 months later because I joined the Motley Fool, not the company's fault, but I certainly have been part of that experience. I also had a mate who was at one point entertaining an offer from a cigarette company to go work for them. Moving out of, again, FMCG, so fast-moving consumer goods, or just food and beverages, basically, into that. And it was like the money they were offering was spectacularly good. And it literally was that question of, if I do my job really, really well, maybe more people don't have lung cancer. So, you know, if I'm going to make this deal with the devil, you know, there is a famous old Kerry Packer quote that I won't say in full because he uses some colourful language. But Packer basically says, well, there's a bit of that in all of us, gentlemen. Name your price. And that his point, well, that's it, right? I mean, we all, morals and ethics matter until the money gets flashed. And then at some point, everyone's got a point at which you say, all right, fine. Okay, sure. I can then start justifying that to myself, sometimes consciously, sometimes subconsciously, because the money gets me across the line.
It's better that I work there because I can steer them in positive ways. And I'll take the money that I get to put to good use to help with my community and rah, rah, rah. I will. Yep. I mean, no one thinks they're evil, right? Yep. So I'm sure plenty of people in the Nazi party thought they were doing really good things. You know, don't ever underestimate the human capacity to rationalize things, to always make yourself the hero of the story.
Yep.
And it's I actually really get it. I mean, it's very easy to sit on the sidelines and go, oh, I would never do that. Yeah. You go, okay, here's $1 million a year. No, I'm too principled. 2 million. Yep. No. 3 million. 4 million. You know? Yeah, like we can go all day. And the point is, you could argue where that point lies, but there is a point.
Yes. Yes.
And can I just say,
go on, please.
Oh, sorry, no, please finish the thought.
I was gonna say, as soon as you admit there's a point, then it really puts the conversation in the right light. Because then it's just a question of how much, rather than, stop being a yes, no principle. And it's just how much money do you need to subvert that principle? There really isn't a principle, but a preference at that point to do what you need to do. And you know, how much is it? I'm often fascinated by how little people, maybe it's a function of their dire circumstances, but when you risk jail for $100, I'm like, you're risking jail for $100 million? I'm like, oh, now there's a conversation, you know, and I'm not going to, I'll say I'm not going to do it. Maybe I would, I don't know. But, you know, it's like people go to jail for small amounts, like, oh, that was a terrible bet, right? Yeah. But so, well, if I can, you know.
Make it worthwhile. Make the risk worthwhile. Right?
If I'm going to spend 3 years in jail, I want to at least have done something, you know, had a chance at something meaningful.
Well, even at the bigger figures, it doesn't, and this is where a lot of you see these sort of white collar criminals, so-called, where like I might already be worth $100 million and I'm going to take a risk to win $5 million more. It's like, man, you're already loaded. Oh. Like where is the
insider trading, mate? The you know, $10,000-$20,000 profit. Like, it's a lot of money, but man, like for 6-12 months, 3 years in jail, you've got to be kidding. Like, it's just, the ROI on that's awful.
It's terrible. But humans, we're selfish, we're greedy. It's all those things. I just want to, on Whitehaven, because I brought up their recent quarterly, September quarter. In the quarter, so this is, again, just to spell it out, that's 3 months, they generated $1.55 billion of cash.
It is astonishing, isn't it?
The net cash position as of September 30 was $1.93 billion. Yeah. This is a company that the market values, I think, about $8 billion or something. Mm-hmm. Or so. It's basically close enough to a quarter, maybe 20% of their entire value is just in net cash there as well.
It's amazing. Like, well, until they buy their shares back, that's the other thing, right? Like, what else could they have done with the cash? They're buying back their own shares.
Yep. Interesting.
Yes, it is. It is. I don't know what to think. Mate, speaking of that, will you come back on Sunday? We do more thinking?
I always look forward to the mailbag episode. So, yes, I absolutely will.
Me too. I look forward to it. Until then, full on.
Cheers.
The Motley Fool and people appearing in this program may have positions in the companies mentioned. General advice only. Please speak to your financial professional to understand how it may pertain to your situation. Subscribe to the free newsletter at fool.com.au/listener. The Motley Fool operates under Financial Services License 400691.